Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man I've had the privilege of working with and admiring as he has continued to work in high offices of the United States government over a long period of time, specifically on matters involving nonproliferation, arms control, verification, nuclear deterrence, and the like, is our first guest. He is Ambassador Robert Joseph. He formerly served, among other things, as an Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security under George W. Bush, also as a U.S. Special Envoy for Nuclear Nonproliferation. He held positions in the Defense Department and the National Security Council and elsewhere. Today, he is a senior scholar at the highly regarded National Institute for Public Policy and always a very welcome guest here. Bob Joseph, good to have you with us. Thanks for joining me.
Frank, thank you for the invitation.
Well, this might be as much a wake as anything else for a man like yourself who knows a lot about how to keep people from getting the bomb and what it means if they do get it. What do you make of President Obama's claim that that's just what he's done with this, what I call, Obama bomb deal?
Well, I think he's done just the opposite. I think this agreement paves the way to a nuclear-armed Iran. I think if you look at the agreement, and let me tell you, it's a tough read, but if you do read it, I think you'll discover that there are major gaps, major ambiguities, and concession after concession on just about every key point.
And when you say concessions, of course, that means concessions on our part, not on the part of the Iranians.
It certainly does. The Iranians get everything that they wanted. And if you look at our initial objectives and stated goals, we get none of it. The agreement doesn't deny Iran a nuclear weapons capability. The agreement that once the constraints expires will not prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon in a very short period of time. And, oh, by the way, mounting it on a ballistic missile, including ballistic missiles with the ability to strike the United States. The agreement, in my view, doesn't even extend the breakout time in any meaningful way. I think fundamentally the agreement is non-verifiable. The provisions from the so-called additional protocol, which the administration has made so much of, are actually weakened in this agreement. One key example of that is in terms of on-site inspections. Under the additional protocol, normally there's a 24-hour period in which the inspected country has to open its gates. Under this agreement, it's at least 24 days. But more likely, given all of the other factors that are going to come into play, it could go on for months, particularly if it goes into the Security Council. And I think also one has to look at the signing bonus that Iran is going to get of up to $140, $150 billion and think about where that money is going to go. It's going to go to sponsor terrorism. It's going to go for more arms, including missiles. It's going to go into their nuclear program. This agreement achieves exactly the opposite of what it is intended to do.
You know, I was talking with Congressman Peter Roskam on this show earlier in the week, Bob, and one of the points that he made, and he's the chairman of the Oversight Subcommittee of the House Ways and Means Committee, a man who knows something about finance and statistics bearing on it. He made the calculation that the Iranian economy being much smaller than ours, of course, if you were to try to assess the size of the windfall that this $140, $150 billion represents for the Iranians by transposing a equivalent amount to the United States with its, as I say, much, much larger GDP, it would be $8 trillion, which I think really brings home the magnitude of what we're doing here in terms of, as you say, walking around money for a lot of very nefarious activities. But let me ask you, and again, you're a serious student of these matters as well as an accomplished practitioner of them. You saw the president's press conference. You saw how he has represented what's been done here, notably, but not exclusively, with respect to verification, also with respect to shutting off the pathways, all the pathways to a bomb, buying time, and rather harshly criticizing those who, like you and I, for that matter, who are opponents of this deal. What did you make of the president's comments and claims?
Well, Frank, I think, you know, I have long thought that the administration's pronouncements on this negotiation have been, you know, spin over substance. But I tell you, I've come to the conclusion, and this was not easy to do, but I think it's very telling. I've come to the conclusion that it is the White House who's more likely to distort the status of the negotiations and the outcome of the negotiations, much more so than the Iranians. And I think in part that is because the Iranians have stuck to their red lines in terms of not including ballistic missiles, insisting on enrichment, all of the key elements, also in the verification area. Whereas we've compromised, we've just made a compromise would be a generous term. We have conceded on all of these issues. So the administration and the president in particular is left with this twisted, convoluted, disingenuous logic.
And lies, if I may say so. to put a fine point on it, yes, as ever, but let's call a spade here. Hey, Pat, we're going to run out of time very quickly, Bob. I just want to hit a couple of other things. You've done a marvelous job of sort of indicting what's going on here, but there are two other things in particular that I'd like to get your thoughts on. One is that we are seeing, as part of this deal, an infusion of international help to enhance the Iranian nuclear program, and also, it appears, to protect it. And it seems, at least from a reasonable reading of the deal, that if the International Atomic Energy Agency says the Iranians are not currently involved in a nuclear weapons program, the time for removing the sanctions or embargo on conventional arms, importing and exporting, and the ballistic missile program can be greatly truncated. Would you comment on those two things specifically?
Sure. I think that what is going on in the Security Council, and I think you'll see this unfolding as early as Monday morning, is a clear and outrageous circumvention of our constitutional procedures. This is something that's encouraged by and engineered by the White House in order to overcome any resistance in our legislative branch, in Congress. It is an outrageous violation of the procedures that that were established in our Constitution and that every other president has respected. What this is designed to do is make Congress the fall guy for not moving forward with the implementation of this debacle, of this historic debacle that they call a non-proliferation agreement. In terms of the arms embargo and lifting the embargo on ballistic missile activities, well, I think those were clear concessions, and they will lead to the strengthening not of the moderates that the administration talks about, but of the Quds force and the most radical elements within this abhorrent regime in Tehran,
who are apparently given a get out of jail free card by name in some cases in one of the annexes to this agreement. Bob, this is really such a travesty, and I think that the clarity with which you are critiquing it and your authority in doing so, as I say, a man who has come by hard work to have a very, very well-deserved reputation for leadership in this field is incredibly important. I appreciate you spending a few minutes to talk with us about it today, and we look forward to working with you in the days that come when Congress hopefully will do its job in rejecting this deal, at least for the United States. Thank you so much, my friend. Keep up the good work at the National Institute for Public Policy and come back to us again very soon. Next up, Dr. Arthur Brooks of the American Enterprise Institute on his new book, The Conservative Heart. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Arthur Brooks, one of the most eminent, articulate, and highly regarded conservatives in Washington, D.C. these days. He is currently the president of the American Enterprise Institute. Formerly served as a professor at Syracuse University and elsewhere. He also is, by sheer brilliant skill, a very accomplished French hornist, a Renaissance man, I think it's fair to say, and we're delighted to have him with us on the occasion of the publication of a new book that he has authored entitled The Conservative Heart: How to Build a Fairer, Happier, and More Prosperous America. Arthur Brooks, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It is terrific to have you with us, and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you, Frank. What an honor for me to be with you today.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this idea. The proposition seems absolutely indisputable. We all want fairer, happier, more prosperous Americans. What is it about conservatism, in your judgment, that is a better bet than the alternative?
Well, the truth of the matter is it's indisputable that conservative ideas have pulled more people out of poverty and given more people lives of opportunity than any system in the history of mankind. It's clear, and this is something, of course, I didn't know until I studied, because I grew up in a liberal home in Seattle. I thought that conservatives don't have a heart. The main reason I wrote the book is to show that conservatives do and how they can express it. When I finally studied economics in my 20s, I was shocked to learn that the ideas of globalization, free trade and free enterprise and American national security, which had kept big parts of the world safe and free, had lifted 2 billion people out of poverty since I was a child. The problem was that conservatives never talked about it, never tried to get the idea across, and never tried to apply these ideas to Americans who are suffering. And so the result was that people have thought for many years, including me as a child, that conservatives don't care about the poor. That's holding the movement back.
Yeah, and we certainly have evidence of that, not just holding the movement back, but preventing its presidential candidate, or at least the Republican presidential candidate, from prevailing in the last national election cycle. Mitt Romney was considered by very many, apparently, not to care about them. We're joined, I'm very pleased to say, by Dr. Arthur Brooks, the president of the American Enterprise Institute, the author of a brand new and potentially very, very transformative book, The Conservative Heart: How to Build a Fairer, Happier, and More Prosperous America. And Arthur, having a conservative heart is something that we're generally accused of being sort of an oxymoron, that we don't, and we're endlessly competing against liberals who demonstrate they have a heart by any number of government programs that seem to be offering fairer and happier and more prosperous America and Americans. What's wrong with their argument, and how do you argue American conservatives can most effectively compete against this idea?
Well, Frank, this book contains effectively a debate manual, and my guarantee is that if people read it and pay attention to the arguments in it, they won't lose their next debate with a liberal who says that conservatives don't care about poor people. I've used these techniques working with presidential candidates and members of Congress when they're getting ready for debates and town hall meetings, and the first thing I say is remember what you truly do care about. Conservatives are very good at talking about money, about the idea of economic efficiency, but that's actually not what you and I care about the most. What outrages us about the American economy today are the people who are being left behind. I don't lay awake nights saying, boy, I wish the tax rates were lower for billionaires. I don't care. What I care about is the fact that people who are poor have a harder time getting ahead under the policies of the Obama administration, and that's got to change. When people see that that's what I'm angry about and that's what I want to change, they're going to see me differently.
And I gather that you find and are able to prescribe real programs or real arguments, at the very least, for demonstrating how conservatives can do that in a manner that does indeed trump the arguments of the left, especially given the track record. And it's not just, of course, Obama's, but as you know better than I, it goes back, I guess, really to the New Deal as much as anything. Is that right?
Yeah, for sure. Americans who are struggling, Americans who are poor, look at conservatives through a sort of a jaundiced eye because of the longstanding idea that conservatives don't care about poor people. What we can do when we start talking about poverty, and when on our heart we really do have the poor and the vulnerable and people who have been left behind front and center,
people will start to listen. There's a good deal of studies, and I go through this in the book. I show with, you know, chapter and verse, real data, that when people just see you talking about the vulnerable, see you with a commitment, even if they don't agree with your policy ideas, see you with a commitment to the least of these in our society, they will start to listen, and they will start, people will start to swing. Independent voters, if they think a Republican and a Democrat are equally compassionate toward the poor, no matter what their policies are, that fact will swing independent voters 10 percentage points to the Republican, no questions asked. I mean, if we did that, game over.
You and I have talked in the past on occasion, Arthur Brooks, about one other facet, of course, of American conservatism, at least as practiced by iconic figures like Ronald Reagan, namely national security. And that's a piece that this show primarily focuses on, as you know. How does that fit into your vision? It is essential, it seems to me, to have an opportunity to pursue happiness, that you be secure. But is that in your playbook as well? And how do you see the folks that are trying to demonstrate this compassion giving people what may oftentimes be the hard truth that security has to be attended to as well?
Well, there are two ways that this is very important, and to me, this is absolutely important. I'm a full-spectrum conservative, and that means that American dominance in world affairs is critically important. It's critically important to the peace and prosperity of the whole world. If you look at a country that's, you know, still a mess when it comes to authoritarianism, China has made just a couple little changes in the system such that since 1980, 680 million Chinese have been pulled out of poverty. Predominant among them is a move toward free trade. That free trade has been facilitated not just by Chinese leaders who said it's okay. It's primarily been facilitated by a Pacific Ocean that for the first time in history that we know of has been free for people to trade across it to the United States with the West. The American military have helped to pull almost 700 million people out of poverty and what's arguably our greatest adversary today. That's what America can do for the world. That's number one. Number two, people deserve the dignity that comes from opportunity. And we know that opportunity on a mass scale only comes from democratic capitalism. When we don't stand up assertively for our views around the world, when we don't remember that democratic capitalist countries automatically are our allies, and we're going to push other countries toward the system that's made America great and free, other people are going to suffer. That's important.
Just to follow that logic, you're surely right that the openness of trading, particularly with the United States, has enabled this transformation in China. And yet, as you said at the end of that riff, the Chinese are arguably now our greatest adversary. We're confronting people who have not brought democratic capitalism along with free trade. They have, in fact, exploited it, it seems, to build a capability that may well threaten all of us. Again, I think underscoring the argument that we do need to attend to security as well as these other concerns.
Absolutely. And, you know, we always have to remember that attending to the dignity of people around the world at the same time trying to keep Americans secure, it's all part of the seamless garment of what American conservatives and liberals, people with a really big heart for how we're trying to help Americans and everybody, how it all hangs together. This is the reason, Frank, I talk about this in the conservative heart, that if you really are a conservative and you do have a big heart for everybody, it really means you need to have a full spectrum understanding of conservative philosophy. These conservatives today who say, I believe in free enterprise, but they're very dovish on American foreign policy. They're not complete in their views of actually how human welfare is going to be best served.
Right, and unlikely to succeed in doing that. Arthur Brooks, we're delighted that you are a full-spectrum conservative and that your American Enterprise Institute promotes those pieces of the stool as well. Thank you for this conversation, and again, congratulations on The Conservative Heart, How to Build a Fairer, Happier, and More Prosperous America. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk to Bill Gertz, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Four Marines died yesterday, not on some foreign battlefield, but in Chattanooga, Tennessee, not in a foxhole, but at their duty stations in America. But make no mistake, they lost their lives in combat at the hands of the same enemy we are facing elsewhere, a jihadist seeking to kill infidel soldiers. He carried out a martyrdom operation that, according to Islam's supremacist Sharia doctrine, will assure him a glorious afterlife. It's bizarre that investigators insist they don't know what motivated Mohammed Abdulaziz to carry out his murderous attacks. It's appalling. President Obama refuses to acknowledge authoritative Islam's catalytic role in such warfare. And it's intolerable that our military personnel being targeted here are not allowed to carry the arms they use to defend themselves in other combat theaters. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Flights with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Flights. Learn more at our new website on the Iran talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Gertz, a man we have the privilege of speaking with each week. He hails from the Washington Free Beacon, where he is a senior editor, and also, of course, the prize-winning column he writes for the Washington Times, Inside the Ring. Bill Gertz, welcome inside our ring. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
I don't even know where to begin, Bill. You've been covering so many really important stories this week, and there's so much going on. But maybe the place to start is the theme that we've been focusing on really for, it seems, months now. But of late, we've now got much, much more reason to be concerned about the Obama bomb deal, as I call it. What do you make of what is in it and what is not in it? And what are you hearing from your sources about their concerns in government?
Well, this Iran deal, as you're aware, is really shaping up to be a national security disaster for the United States. Basically, I did a piece looking at a news analysis of the accord, and it's really deficient in leaving out key facilities. For example, there's no reference to the Parchin military facility, which is where the Iranians conducted explosive tests to make a nuclear bomb, which is the central issue of this whole agreement. The rest of it covers uranium enrichment facilities, which Iran has deceptively claimed were for nuclear generating electrical power. Also, the Bushehr reactor, built by Russia along the coast of the Persian Gulf is not included. And analysts say that that could produce plutonium for scores of bombs a year, and yet it was not even covered by the agreement. So there are a lot of deficiencies. Again, the verification procedures are really problematic. They're not unprecedented, like the administration says. They get a delay of 24 days, and there's no U.S. inspectors allowed to be on the International Atomic Energy Agency inspection team. This was a major concession to the Iranians.
It really sounds like a formula for a sort of complete Potemkin verification scheme, where we cannot have confidence that actually we know what they're doing in places where they're likely to be doing it. But Bill, doesn't this concern people in the Pentagon that we're watching what appears to be an enriching of a nation that is capable of all kinds of malevolence in a very strategically important part of the world, and is possibly not only going to have immense amounts of money with which to scale all that up, but also access to a whole host of weapons that, besides the nuclear ones, will be posing threats to our ships and shipping and other interests and allies in the region?
Well, I haven't heard anything from the Pentagon about the deal. What I have heard is that the Pentagon, as you know, is scrambling to try to deal with the crisis of funding. And I think this may have been part of the president's strategy, you know, strip the Pentagon of all of its funding. We're now facing, you know, more than $800 billion in cuts at the Pentagon, and they're just scrambling to try and find ways to do their basic requirement.
With fewer and fewer forces as well as resources. Of course, since we last talked, Bill, I think we've had an announcement of another 40,000 reduction in the U.S. Army's, you know, active duty forces. We're watching readiness plummet, as you know so well. We're watching any kind of modernization programs stretched out or canceled outright. It really is a formula in a much more dangerous world for a security disaster for us, don't you think?
Absolutely. The worst part of this deal is that it's giving the Iranian Islamic Republic huge legitimacy that it didn't have in the past. And, of course, that's going to really fire up its forces in places like Syria, in places like other parts of the Middle East. We see them in Yemen. So this is really a formula for disaster. We can only hope that the Congress will take action to really try to derail this deal.
Yeah. Well, we're certainly hard at work on that very proposition, but I must say it is going to be made more difficult by what we're learning is the administration's plan to get a vote in the UN Security Council as early as 9 o'clock on Monday, according to Ambassador John Bolton, without much debate, to say the least. And it will further, you know, compound the dangers that we're facing from this deal. Bill, let me turn to a couple of other things that you've been covering this week and inside the ring at the Washington Times and at your Free Beacon outlet as well. Most immediately on China, we've had overflights of U.S. B-52s in the Pacific to try to demonstrate our power projection capabilities there. I'd be interested in your thoughts on how the Chinese are likely to perceive those ephemeral things rather than the permanent efforts they're making to establish their presence and control over the South China Sea with man-made islands. And also the latest on the OPM attack, who was involved in that and how they did it.
Yeah, first, on the bomber mission, the two B-52 bombers from Barksdale Air Force Base conducted a 44-hour nonstop flight to Australia and back. They didn't even land. But this was a demonstration of U.S. regional capabilities. They were part of some Australian exercises, and they were conducted significantly very close to the South China Sea, where recent tensions have risen over China's reclamation of islands and the militarization of those islands, which have rattled the neighbors from Vietnam to Japan. So this was a good step. That they call it a BAD, which is BAAD, Bomber Assurance and Deterrence Mission. And it was meant clearly as a signal to China. Whether China gets that signal or not is hard to say. Now, if we had sent maybe a dozen bombers over there, I think they would have got a different message. On the OPM hack, this is a very significant story that I broke today in the Washington Free Beacon on how security researchers have finally tracked down two Chinese government-run hacking groups. One is called Deep Panda, the other is called WECBI. They're using U.S. Computer service companies in Los Angeles, Nevada, and elsewhere, Denver, to conduct cyber attacks. This is the increasing sophistication of these cyber attacks is to, again, use domestic infrastructure as a way to try and thwart U.S. intelligence agencies from identifying the source of the attack. So it's really significant in that I was able to, for the first time, identify how the Chinese are conducting some of these massive bulk personal data collection cyber attacks.
And Bill, just remind us, what seems to be the focus of these personal information data raids and their implications, again, from a security perspective?
It's part of a major spying operation by the Chinese military, and the 2PLA in particular. They've been vacuuming up millions and millions of records on Americans. We saw that in the Office of Personnel Management hack, 22.1 records on people who hold security clearances, a large percentage of them, were vacuumed up. In addition, last year in February, they attacked the Anthem healthcare provider and stole 80 million records, including many government officials. So it's clearly they're using big data for both future cyber attacks as well as traditional espionage and intelligence gathering.
Bill, two other stories caught my attention. We don't have time to do justice probably to either one of them, but I do want to salute you for your reporting. Parallels that you've drawn between the deal we just talked about with Iran and that preceded it with North Korea, to dismal effect. And the other parallels between Hillary Clinton's emails and the security breaches that they represented, and the former director of Central Intelligence, John Deutsch, experience.
Well, real quickly, on the John Deutsch affair, it's very similar to the discovery that Hillary Clinton was using classified information on her home server. Is very similar to a case back in the 90s where the CIA director was found to have put incredibly large amounts of highly sensitive intelligence information on his home computer network, and he was actually investigated and charged for it criminally and was pardoned by President Clinton. And now you have a case where Hillary Clinton has done the same thing, and there seems to be no interest in conducting an investigation of this very serious security breach.
It's truly a travesty, and I trust that in the remaining months before elections are going to determine whether Hillary Clinton is not just the Democratic nominee, but also President of the United States, others, including your good self, will be drilling down on this issue, because I really think it represents a national security malpractice and should be considered a disqualifier. Bill, we'll talk about North Korea and Iran on other occasions, I know, in the future. Thank you very much for joining us today and for the terrific work you do at the Washington Times and the Washington Free Beacon. We'll talk with you again next week about those and more. Next up, Ilya Feoktistov, one of the preeminent researchers on jihad in America, talks about the attack in Chattanooga yesterday. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Ilya Feoktistov, one of the most thoughtful and, I think, astute analysts of the jihad in America. He is today the research director of a wonderful organization in Boston, Massachusetts. It's called Americans for Peace and Tolerance. And they have done incredibly important work, in particular, about jihadism being inculcated in mosques in this country, notably the Islamic Society of Boston Mosque, but also others elsewhere across the country, including in Tennessee. And we wanted to talk with Ilya about his research at a moment when federal authorities are putting out the word that they are just bemused as to what possibly could have been the motive of one Mohammed Abdulaziz, who murdered four American Marines yesterday in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Ilya, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm sorry that we're consulting with you on this very sad occasion, but I fear worse is to come if we don't get this sorted out, and you've been doing a terrific job at trying to help all of us sort these things. So welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Talk a bit, if you would, Ilya, about some of the insights that you've gleaned over the years about what's happening in Tennessee at the moment. I understand you're a native son of Nashville, specifically from a previous act of jihad in a neighboring state, and what it tells us about what's going on in lots of places in America, not just in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Well, a lot of people don't remember this, but actually this is not the first murder of American troops on U.S. soil from Tennessee who was inspired by radical Islam. In 2009, the first al-Qaeda murder on U.S. soil since 9/11 was the murder of Private Andy Long at a Little Rock, Arkansas recruitment station. Same exact MO, same profile. The guy drives up in a car, shoots at the station, and flees. This kid, Abdul Hakim Muhammad was his name, was radicalized in Nashville, Tennessee. He was born Carlos Bledsoe, son of a African-American Memphis family, wonderful father. And I actually went back and I looked at his father's testimony in front of Congress in 2011 at Congressman Peter King's hearings on homegrown radicalization. And what I read was a very important line in Melvin Bledsoe's testimony was, "One thing is for sure, it will happen again. We've been warning about radical networks in Nashville, Tennessee, and other areas of Tennessee here for the past 4 years since we put out a film called Losing Our Sons about this murder in Little Rock, Arkansas. And unfortunately, the local and the federal authorities have not taken heed to our warnings."
You know, this is such an important data point. The film Losing Our Sons, which Americans for Peace and Tolerance produced with considerable help from you and your colleague Charles Jacobs, of course, is such a clarion call about what is happening in our own country. And it isn't lone wolves, and it certainly isn't people who are just engaged in workplace violence. These are jihadists. Talk a bit about how they are so-called radicalized and identify some of the places in which that's happening, if you would, Ilya.
You know, interestingly, I just read an article in the LA Times that offered a very interesting data point about this new shooter, Abdulaziz, and the fact that he's been very recently living in Nashville. He's from Chattanooga originally, but he's been living in Nashville. And our documentary, Losing Our Sons, the research that we did, we've identified several mosques in the Nashville area that serve as incubators of radicalism, including the Islamic Center of Nashville and the Al-Farouk Mosque in Nashville. These are mosques whose imams we have on audio and videotape encouraging hatred for the United States, that the United States is the worst country on earth, that Jews and Christians should be hated, and that Muslims should strive to create Islamic states all over the world. And these are actual imams, actual, in their own words, that we've identified from Nashville.
Now, let me just ask you, Ilya, if you have access to this information and you've been able to draw the inevitable, certainly reasonable conclusions that these imams, these mosques are incubators of jihadism, what on earth is going on with the federal government that can't seem to see jihad, even if it's confronting it squarely in the face?
Well, as we document in the film Losing Our Sons, the federal government has, number one, forbidden FBI agents from going inside mosques and monitoring mosques from the inside because they're religious institutions, which I think is ridiculous. Because mosques, unfortunately, in the United States is where a lot of this activity happens. If we're going to prevent it, we really need to be there looking at it. Number two, the Obama administration has gutted the training manuals for the FBI and various other agencies to exclude, to censor out any understanding of radical Islam. Now, I'm a Russian immigrant to Nashville. I was born in the Soviet Union. Back during the Cold War, American CIA, FBI agents studied Russian culture, studied communist writings, studied the ideology that drove our or your enemies at the time. I don't view this as anti-Russian racism, but unfortunately, Obama thinks that just by studying Islamic ideology, this is somehow a bigoted effort by the law enforcement agencies and therefore must be forbidden, which is very unfortunate because the dictum, know your enemy, know yourself, 1,000 battles, 1,000 victories from Sun Tzu is still very, very irrelevant today.
It's more than just unfortunate. What is really happening here is willfully blinding our law enforcement personnel, and for that matter, as you say, other agencies of the government whose responsibility is to protect us against these kinds of threats, from understanding the threats. And it's axiomatic, as Sun Tzu said, that you're unable to defeat an enemy you don't know. When you look at all of this, Ilya, and again, you've done tremendous work on documenting its operations, notably in addition to Tennessee, in your now native city of Boston. When you hear that we can't figure out what the motive is, when you hear that this has nothing to do with Islam, which I'm sure we'll have explained to us shortly, if not not already. When you hear that these are lone wolves and that they are acting out perhaps on the basis of something they picked up on the internet or some misguided notions about their religion of Islam. What do you think? And what should we all think and say, most especially, to those who are, in fact, charged with securing us against such threats?
I think either I'm crazy or the federal government is crazy, and I think, unfortunately, it's the latter, including much of the media. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous when I see headlines in, you know, the L.A. Times today, federal authorities see the motive behind the shooting as a mystery. It's not really a mystery. In fact, it's absolutely clear to everyone who has any sort of sense. And it absolutely drives me insane to see these kinds of things.
It may be driving you insane, but you're not crazy yet. That's for sure. The work you're doing at Americans for Peace and Tolerance is deeply appreciated by all of us. Ilya Feoktistov, keep it up and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.